I got the post for a reason. I think there might be something about me on page 6.
Eee! Leland says. Let's look together, come on.
She slides around to his side of the table, picks up the post, and slaps it down in front of him.
You do the honors.
Frey stares at the paper. What is he going to find? He tries to remember if he heard any drones during the night.
Or I can? Leland says.
No, I'll do it.
He opens the paper to page 6, and there is a photograph of Frey and Leland kissing outside the Nantucket airport. The headline reads, Frasier Dooley's Tony Island Getaway with Feminist Icon Leland Gladstone. To her credit, Leland doesn't shriek or scream, but when she pulls her reading glasses out of her purse, he notices her hands are shaking.
Coffee mogul Frasier Dooley greets paramour Leland Gladstone outside Nantucket Memorial Airport. The couple were then whisked away by a private vehicle.
Leland turns to Frey, and all he can think is how sexy she looks in her glasses, like a naughty librarian.
That's why our server said I was from the Post, she whispers. And that's why my mother texted. They've already seen this.
Everyone reads the Post, he thinks, but only the brave admit it.
He can't gauge where Leland is going to land on this. He's pretty sure her brand depends on her sexual identity, which is, well, whatever it is, it's probably not compatible with a weekend rendezvous on the arm of a white male billionaire.
I'm sorry, he says. I attract all kinds of attention because of the business. And the whole thing with Anna has made things exponentially worse.
Has Anna seen this? Leland asks. Was that her calling this morning?
Frey nods.
I'm the one who's sorry, Leland says. I know who took this picture. There were two women on my plane who asked for a selfie, and then when we were walking out of the terminal, they were behind me, and I overheard them recognizing you.
So they took our picture and sold it to the Post, Frey says.
I'm sure they think they won the internet jackpot, Leland says.
She picks up the paper. Does feminist icon make me sound old?
Icon is better than mogul, Frey says. Mogul is such an ugly, hobbity word.
I can't believe this, Leland whispers. I mean, it wouldn't be funny, except it's true. I am your weekend paramour.
Will you get canceled? Frey asks. Will you be hounded by trolls? Do your readers think you sleep with women?
My sexuality is considered fluid, Leland says. It's 2023. Everyone's sexuality is considered fluid, Frey.
Oh, Frey says. His sexuality doesn't feel fluid. It feels very Leland-specific. So this isn't necessarily bad for you, then?
I don't know, and I don't care, Leland says. I've been happier the past 24 hours than I've been, maybe ever.
This statement nearly brings Frey to tears. He hasn't been this happy maybe ever either. He thinks back to his much younger self, glaring at the payphone in his freshman dorm after just having hung up on Leland, who was back in her bedroom on Deep Dean Road in Baltimore. What had they been arguing about? Who knows? Maybe Frey told her he was pledging a fraternity. Maybe she told him she and Mallory were going to a party with boys from Gilman. He then pictures himself in the back of Mallory's blazer, calling Leland every swear word he knew under his breath after she strolled off to 21 Federal with Kip Sudbury. He had no idea then that all he needed for things to finally be perfect between him and Leland was patience. A lot of patience. Bess. Everything about her Friday evening improves all at once. Not only has she traded up in the date department, she bumped into Link Dooley, a boy she has thought about ever since she met him on Nantucket 3 years earlier, But she is also leaving behind the Drake and Buffalo Wings scene at Roofers Union for Lapis, her favorite restaurant in the district. Lapis is quiet and elegant. It gives off strong bistro vibes, only with sitar music. The owner, Shamin, gives Bess a smile when she sees her enter with Link. Shamin leads them to one of the tables in the window. Bess thanks her profusely, even though, because of the conversation she's about to have, she would prefer a table tucked behind one of the latticed wooden screens. "Wow," Link says. "You get star treatment."
"I come here a lot," Bess says.
She doesn't mention that this was the one place in D.C. where Ursula would eat in public while she was campaigning. Shamin made every accommodation to ensure that Ursula, Jake, and Bess were comfortable.
"I love Bolani," Link says, "and Kabuli Palau."
"The palau here is off the chain," Bess says. "It's made with cinnamon rice."
"We have to get the halwa for dessert," Link says.
Bess beams. Link really does like Afghan food. All she can imagine is the lobbyist looking at the menu and ordering a chicken kebab and French fries.
"Let's get the pakoras to start," she says.
She wants to pinch herself. How did she get so lucky? Once they're settled with a glass of Albarino for Bess and a beer for Link, Bess realizes this happiness comes with a price. She has promised to tell Link what was going on between her father and his mother. Link tears a piece off his flat oval of bolani and dips it in yogurt sauce, then raises his eyes to Bess. He's better looking than any lobbyist, she decides. She loves his shaggy blonde hair and his bluish-green eyes that remind her of the ocean the day she first met him.
"So your dad told you what was going on?" Link says.
"He told me on the way back to St. Louis after we saw you," Bess says.
She busies herself with her own bolani. Her father made her solemnly swear never to tell a soul, and she had promised. She understood the gravity of the situation at the time. Her mother was running for president, and there could be no scandalous family secrets floating to the surface. If Bess told her best friend Pageant or Casey, the campaign manager, in a moment of weakness, it would be all over. Her father was entrusting her with a secret he'd kept longer than she'd been alive. She realized that he was telling her because she was the one who had made the trip to Nantucket with him, because she'd asked him what the whole thing meant, because he loved her, because he was sodden with emotions when he left Mallory's bedside holding the rented guitar, because Mallory was a day or two from death, and by telling Bess what had happened between them, he was keeping Mallory alive. Their circumstances were different now, of course. Ursula had lost the election, and she was no longer in public life. No one cared about Ursula de Guernsey and Jake McLeod anymore. Their divorce hadn't even been noted by the press. It wouldn't matter who Bess told about this secret now. But she still felt guilty because it was her father's story to tell, and not hers. What would he think about Bess sharing it with Lincoln Dooley? Well, he would either be appalled, or he would think that Link deserved the truth, just as Bess did. She'll go with the second choice, since she can't very well back out now. Link is looking at her expectantly.
"They had an affair," Bess says. "One weekend a year. Labor Day weekend, actually."
Link's brow creases.
"Does that have anything to do with why everyone is up on Nantucket this weekend?"
"They're reliving the summer of 1993. That's when your mom and my dad met. Your uncle and your dad were there, too."
"Ah," Link says, 30 years ago.
"Yep."
"So did they see each other only on Labor Day weekend?"
"Yes. Always on Nantucket. From 1993 until, well, 2020.
"Where was I when this was happening?" Link asks.
He looks at Bess as though she might have the answer.
You know what? I always, always spent Labor Day weekend out in Seattle with my dad. All through growing up, I did that. Except for one year I went to D.C. to see my uncle, and another year I went with an old girlfriend to New York City. Bess feels herself bristling at the mention of an old girlfriend. My dad said they met every single Labor Day weekend, no matter what. Always at your cottage. They never missed a year.
And nobody found out? Link says. Your mom never found out?
A server sets their order of pakoras on the table. They're golden brown, fragrant, and still too hot to touch, never mind eat. Bess thanks him and points to her wine glass. She's definitely going to need another.
My mom found out, or suspected anyway. She went to Nantucket in 2019 to confront Mallory.
Link's eyes widen.
She was running for president. She didn't think she could have it coming to light.
Why did she go to Nantucket? Why didn't she just talk to your dad?
She was afraid my dad would leave her, Bess says. She believed the only person who could put an end to the affair was your mom.
Link leans back in his chair and takes a sip of his beer. Bess nudges the plate of pakoras toward him. He takes one and blows on it.
I'll ask the obvious question. Why didn't your dad just leave your mom earlier? Why didn't he leave her in year 5 or 10 or 15?
My mother...
Link sets the fritter down without tasting it and stares out the window.
She never got married.
She had boyfriends when she was young and she hooked up with my dad, obviously. And there was a guy she was serious about when I was little, but that didn't work out.
She was alone. I could never understand it.
My friends didn't get it. So many of them thought she was super hot. My grandma used to get on her case all the time about meeting someone.
He sets his elbows on the table and drops his head in his hands.
Now, all I can think is that she wasted her life, year after year, waiting for Labor Day weekend to roll around. How do you live like that? Only seeing the person you love 3 or 4 days a year.
My dad said it was, well, excruciating was his exact word.
Link gives a short, bitter laugh. Excruciating for him? No offense, Bess, but he was married. He went right home to your mother.
Link pushes away the pakora on his share plate and Bess thinks, oh, no, no, no. She only wanted to tell Link what she knew. She didn't mean to hurt him or make him angry.
You can see how this little arrangement...
Same time next year, Bess says. It was a movie they used to watch.
Yeah, well, the same time next year was profoundly unfair to my mother.
That's what I told my dad, Bess says. The arrangement was lopsided and sexist.
Bess remembers how Jake had patiently endured her tirade about white male privilege.
He assured me that the arrangement was Mallory's choice. I guess there were a couple of junctures when my dad said he wanted to be with her on a permanent basis, and she turned him down. She didn't want to leave Nantucket.
She never would have left the island.
She said she was happy. He told me she had a full life.
Bess's second glass of wine is dropped off by none other than Shamin herself.
Is everything okay here?
Shamin asks, eyeing the untouched pakoras.
We are busy preparing your entrees.
Delicious,
Bess says, too eagerly, and she takes a perfunctory bite of pakora.
Very good,
Shamin says, smiling, and thankfully, she leaves them. Bess turns back to Link.
I'm not pretending to know what your mother's life was like. You would know that far better than me. But my dad claims she had her job, her cottage, friends, a community, and you.
Link looks at her incredulously, and she can't help but agree with him. She's ridiculous.
She's trying to justify what happened between their parents when it was, quite clearly, unfair to Mallory. But then, Link does an amazing thing. He reaches across the table for her hand. Bess tries to act natural, but she instantly flushes from the neck up. She likes Link so much. Okay, she realizes she doesn't really know him, but she's been drawn to him since she first set eyes on him, stepping out of the cottage on Nantucket. He'd looked so forlorn, a boy on the verge of losing his mother. He'd been trying to escape the adults inside and, like Bess, he was probably wondering what the hell Jake McLeod was doing there. But he was kind and funny with Bess, and she thought she'd seen a spark in his eyes, like maybe he thought Bess was pretty, and then he offered to show her the beach. She'd wanted him to ask for her number before she left, but her dad had been standing there, and it wasn't clear if she and Link would ever see each other again, so what would be the point? "Don't you think everyone deserves to find love?" Link asks. "Isn't that what we're all programmed to search for? Someone we can connect with? A lover, a friend? Someone to build a life with?" Bess nods, but is afraid to speak. She isn't sure if Link is trying to tell her she might be that person for him. Could she be so lucky? Or if he's blaming Jake for keeping Mallory from finding such a person. "They found love," she wants to say. Maybe it didn't look like other people's love. A split-level house with a two-car garage, family road trips in the summer, date night on Saturday. But that doesn't mean it wasn't romantic or real. That doesn't mean they weren't devoted. Something about the way her father described his time with Mallory made it sound very real and very romantic. And if 28 consecutive summers, no matter what, wasn't devotion, then what was? But before Bess can articulate any of this, two things happen. The first is that a server arrives with their entrees, and the second is that Link's phone plays Toto's Africa. Bess loves that song too, and the screen lights up with the name Stacy. Link stands up as his plate of palau lands. "I have to take this." Bess blinks. "Okay?" "Outside," he says. "I'll be right back." "Who is Stacy?" she wonders. "An old girlfriend? A current girlfriend?" She tries not to worry. It might be his boss or a coworker or a friend. She feels relieved that they are finished with the Jake and Mallory story. Maybe when Link gets back, they can eat and talk about their own lives like two normal people on a date. Bess watches Link on the sidewalk on his phone, his head bent, his ear plugged. She considers the food. It would be rude for her to start without him, but she's hungry, so she helps herself to one of the pakoras, which have finally cooled enough to eat. She devours one and is reaching for another when a guy takes Link's seat. Bess says, her mouth full. She swallows. "Wrong table?"
"You're Bess, right? Bess McLeod?"
The guy looks like a Hollister model, or like the lead actor in a sexy HBO series about the Ivy League's secret societies. And then, of course, it dawns on Bess. It's the lobbyist. "Aiden?" she says.
"You ditched me," he says. "I finally made it to Roofers Union and you were gone."
Bess stares at Aiden Heideck's perfectly coiffed dark hair, his sleepy brown eyes, and his square shoulders, and realizes that, in the excitement of leaving Roofers Union with Link, she forgot to cancel this date. And not only that, she continued to share her location with Aiden.
"I'm so sorry," she says.
He tilts his head and gives her a slow smile.
"It's okay. I was the one who was late."
"Yeah, but that wasn't your fault. You got stuck on the metro."
"That I did."
He looks at the food on the table.
"I don't mean to be a poor sport, but I don't like Indian food."
"It's Afghan."
"Even worse," he says. I was really looking forward to wings at the roof.
Only then does he seem to notice Link's empty beer glass and the share plate with the now cold pakora.
Oh, snap. Are you here with somebody?
Bess is at an utter loss. She checks out the window. Link is still on the phone, standing just off the curb in the street between two parked cars. Aiden follows her eyes and taps the glass.
That guy?
He's an old friend. He showed up at Roofer's Union and... Oh God, Aiden, I'm so sorry. I meant to let you know I was leaving. I'm not like this, I swear.
Aiden gets to his feet.
It's fine, he says. I would suggest that we reschedule when you're not quite so busy, but now that I've seen you in person, I don't think I want to bother.
Bess recoils. Did he just say that? She knows he's angry, but that was dirty. He leans down by her ear and says,
The only reason I asked for this date is because I know who your mother is.
Link approaches the table.
Hey?
Aiden turns around and smirks at him.
She's all yours, bruh.
Bess is so angry, she wants to dump her palau all over Aiden's gorgeous lobbyist head. Instead, she stares at the table and waits for Aiden to leave the restaurant. She can't make a scene, not here. She wants to ask Shamin to wrap everything to go so that Bess can eat it alone in her apartment. Link was on the phone with Stacy for so long that all Bess can imagine is he's about to offer an excuse to cut dinner short so he can meet her. How can she live in a city filled with men and still not be able to meet anyone suitable? When she raises her head, Link has retaken his seat. He's leaning forward, staring at her.
Friend of yours?
That was Aiden, Bess says. The lobbyist.
Aiden was the last man on earth she should have chosen off Bumble. Now that I've seen you in person, I don't think I want to bother. The only reason I asked for this date is because I know who your mother is.
He seemed like a real peach, and I'm sorry you missed out on spending the evening with him, but I'll try to make it up to you.
Link reaches for Bess's hand again. Link doesn't seem like he's in a particular hurry to rush out, but Bess is wary.
Everything okay with your phone call?
Link shakes his head.
It was my uncle's girlfriend. Ex-girlfriend? Almost fiancé? The woman who turned down his marriage proposal, which was what made him want to organize the Nantucket weekend? Yeah, that was her. She's had time to process. She's decided she wants to marry him after all, so she showed up at the house, but he wasn't there, so she called him and it went straight to voicemail, and she's convinced he blocked her, which he probably did, because what else would you do to the woman who turned down your proposal? And she wanted to know if I knew where he was.
Bess is overcome with relief. Stacy isn't Link's girlfriend. Stacy is his uncle's girlfriend.
Did you tell her?
Link shrugs. I said I wasn't sure, but I thought he'd made plans out of town with a friend.
Ah, Bess says. Did she think you meant a female friend?
Link squeezes Bess's hand, then lets go so he can dig into the palau.
I don't want to worry about Coop's romantic life, he says. I'd like to focus on my own.
After dinner, Link asks if he can walk Bess home, and she says yes, and they stroll the streets of Washington, holding hands. When they reach the Sedgwick, Link escorts her to the door, and Bess says,
Thank you for saving me from the lobbyist.
Link lays a gentle hand on the side of her face, and then he leans in and kisses her. It's the best kiss Bess has ever received, sweet, warm, just enough to leave her aching for more.
Oh, she whispers.
Link kisses her again. He pulls her to him, and soon they are making out while moths beat around the light over their heads. Bess pulls away.
Would you like to come up?
Link takes a breath, and Bess wonders, Does he not want to come up? Was something wrong with her kissing? Link says,
I feel like I should let you know something.
Okay, Bess says.
Seeing you once a year isn't going to be enough for me, he says. So, if we're following in our parents' footsteps, or fulfilling their thwarted destiny or whatever, that part has to change.
Bess pulls out her key. She can't hide her smile.
Deal, she says.
Cooper. On Saturday, Cooper wakes up at noon. Noon? When is the last time he's done that? College? High school? He's an up-at-the-crack-of-dawn, seize-the-day kind of guy. A morning person. But when he finally unsticks his eyelids, he can't deny he lacks any motivation to get up off the wide, comfortable sofa. Except that he's the host here. Ever so gently, he lifts his head from the cushion and gazes around the room. Nobody is in the cottage, though he hears voices on the beach. Coop swings his feet to the floor and stands up. He overdid it. Drank too much, stayed out too late. Deep inside him, like a coin dropped in a well, rests a small sense of accomplishment. He closed the chicken box. The person he would like to tell this to is Stacy. He pours himself a giant glass of ice water and heads out to the beach where Jake, Leland, and Frey are enjoying the sun. Jake is in his trunks sitting in a chair with a book open on his chest. His hair is wet. Frey and Leland are lying side by side on a blanket. Leland is in a black tank suit and a straw hat, and Frey is beside her. Something is funny about that. Cooper squints. It's bright outside, and he goes inside for his sunglasses. When he comes back out, he sees that Frey and Leland's legs are intertwined in a way that looks more than friendly.
Hello, all, Coop says, collapsing in an empty chair. How are you feeling, old man? Frey asks.
Coop can see that Frey is also stroking Leland's shoulder.
Okay. Jake says, want me to make you an omelet? You must be starving.
Coop feels queasy.
I think I'll go for a swim first, then see if I can handle food. So listen, Frey says. I booked a sunset sail on the Endeavor for Leland and me tonight, and then I got the two of us a highly sought-after reservation at the boarding house. I've heard their lobster spaghetti absolutely slaps. So I hope that's cool with you.
Sunset sail? Lobster spaghetti? What does that mean, it slaps? The for Leland and me part he understands. Frey and Leland want to go to dinner alone. Coop made a 9:30 reservation for the four of them at Nautilus, but who is he kidding? He's not up for sitting down to dinner at 9:30. He'll fall asleep in his bow buns. He'll cancel Nautilus. He and Jake can get a pizza and watch college football. He feels a bit bummed that they aren't doing something all together, but he can't ignore his relief. He has been set free of expectations. Coop spends the afternoon waiting for the fog in his head to clear. The swim helps a little, and the pillowy omelet that Jake serves him with two pieces of toasted something natural herb bread soaks up the beer and the shot of tequila he did the night before. The tequila had been handed to him by a member of a bachelor party who called him Pops. He sits on the beach for a while, but the sun makes his headache worse. Jake suggests Hair of the Dog. He's drinking a dark and stormy, but Coop can't think about alcohol. Frey and Leland disappear inside, and Coop says to Jake, did something happen between them?
They have a thing, Jake deadpans, a thing that refuses to die.
Since the mid-80s, Coop says. He lowers his voice. I thought Leland liked women?
Jake shrugs.
Jake dozes off in his chair, and Coop heads inside to grab a Coke, thinking some caffeine might help. He sees Frey and Leland pop out of Mallory's bedroom all dressed up. Dressed up for Frey is jeans and a white button-down shirt that looks like it could have been pulled off the rack at Sears, but probably is by an Italian designer and costs $1,100. Leland is wearing a fitted black dress. After only one afternoon in the sun, she's tan.
"Have fun, kids," Coop says.
He is looking at Fraser Dooley and Leland Gladstone in 2023, but he's also having a flashback to Frey and Leland standing up against the cinder block wall outside the Calvert Hall boys' locker room after one of Frey's lacrosse games. Rumor around the school was that Leland gave him special favors if he scored a goal.
"Hey, you can sleep in Link's room tonight," Frey says. "I've been upgraded."
Leland kisses Frey's cheek. "Damn straight." Coop laughs and shakes his head. He loves them both. If they're happy, he's happy. After they leave, Coop thinks maybe he will go into Link's room and lie down. But he stops in front of the bookshelves, which hold not only Mallory's impressive library, but also a bunch of framed photographs. Many of them are of Link growing up and of Mallory and Link together, though there are also some wonderful photos of Mallory and Cooper as children, which Mallory must have taken when they cleared out the house on Deepdene Road after Senior and Kitty were killed. There's a shot of Cooper, Mallory, Senior, and Kitty taken during brunch in the green room at the Hotel DuPont in Wilmington, Delaware. The blessings would always go the Saturday after Thanksgiving, because that was the first day the hotel was decorated for Christmas. Kitty used to go to the green room with her own parents, so the brunch tradition was very important to her. Coop recalls suffering through it his junior and senior years in high school, following the epic Friday after Thanksgiving parties he used to attend. That's definitely the case in this picture. Cooper's eyes are bloodshot, his hair is uncombed, and his tie crooked. But what makes him laugh out loud is Mallory in her Kelly Green monogrammed sweater and kilt, a kilt, and knee socks. She must be 14 and she's wearing knee socks. Tears burn his eyes as he laughs. She was such a nerd. Before she had braces, she used to have buck teeth, and Cooper would tease her relentlessly. He also teased her about her adoration of Rick Springfield, her addiction to General Hospital, and the stubborn cowlick in her hair that she would spend the moments before leaving for school fruitlessly trying to tame. Coop knows that Mallory resented him growing up. Things came easily to him. Good grades, sports, charming all the adults in his life so that he got pretty much whatever he wanted. Mallory was shyer, a bit socially awkward. She preferred to stay in her room, lounging on her fuzzy purple beanbag chair, reading. Oh, and she ate saltines with butter. Coop closes his eyes. He hasn't thought of her saltine and butter addiction in decades. He picks up another picture where Coop is maybe 10 and Mallory 8. It's Easter. Coop is in a navy blazer, Mallory in a pink dress and headband, buck teeth protruding from her smile. They're standing in front of the fireplace at their grandparents' house, holding baskets filled with candy. Coop can practically smell his grandfather's pipe smoke. The next picture he picks up moves him even further back in time. Coop is maybe 7, Mallory 5, and they're wearing the lederhosen that their grandparents brought back from a trip to Munich. This picture is serious blackmail material. They look ridiculous. Coop laughs until he cries, and then he's bawling like a baby, because Mallory was his kid sister, and he misses her. He sets the lederhosen picture next to a picture of his Aunt Greta and Uncle Beau, who were the original owners of this cottage. Cooper remembers when Mallory was sent to Nantucket for the summer as a kid. He thought she was being punished. Little did he know. There were no pictures of Mallory with Jake, obviously, since their relationship was like a state secret, and no pictures of Mallory with any other men. Coop wonders then, as he often has, if there was something wrong with him and his sister. Mallory had a child but never married. Coop has been married 5 times, but none of the unions lasted and he never had children. Was it random luck that things ended up that way? Or had they been defective somehow? Kitty and Senior, although they each had their faults, set a wonderful example. They were devoted and attentive and respectful of each other. Cooper Senior could be impenetrable emotionally, but he had a soft spot for his wife. There had always been romance in the house. Long-stemmed roses just because. An evening spent on the couch in front of the fire, Kitty lying with her head in Senior's lap. Maybe they set an example that was too hard to live up to. Cooper thinks of Dr. Robb's point that he has suffered a lot of loss. It was all weighing on his shoulders now. He missed his family. He would give everything he owned to be back in the green room at the Hotel DuPont. He's overtired and growing very emotional. He needs a nap. Coop slinks into Link's room and crashes face down on the bed. When Cooper wakes up, the sun is setting in a blaze of pink on the horizon. Link's room, which has a window onto the beach, is suffused with rose gold light. Coop finds Jake in the living room drinking a beer in front of the Clemson-Ole Miss game.
Hey, Coop says, should we order a pizza?
There's something I forgot to tell you earlier, Jake says. Do you remember that woman Brooke from last night?
Yeah,
Coop says.
The teacher who was friends with Apple?
He's having a hard time coming up with Brooke's face, though he recalls thinking she was pretty.
I bumped into her this morning on my run, Jake says. She was walking her dog.
Wow, small island, Coop says.
Then he wonders if maybe Jake found Brooke attractive too.
That would be great.
Jake needs to get back in the game after losing Mallory and splitting from Ursula. And it would be so fitting, him dating the woman who replaced Mallory. Or would it be weird?
She gave me her number, Jake says, and she told me to tell you to call her.
Me? Coop says, laughing. This is unexpected.
Or is it? Now that he thinks of it, he was dancing with her pretty exclusively.
Do you remember that they invited us to that beach picnic tomorrow?
That's right, Coop says.
He forgot about the beach picnic, but they were definitely invited.
Send me her number now. I'll text her and find out what time.
Coop marvels at how well Sunday's schedule works out. At 8 o'clock, Coop, Jake, and Frey play 9 holes of golf at Maya Comet while Leland bikes to a hot yoga class. They all meet back at the cottage for bagels and fruit salad and coffee, of course. And after a swim and a nap in the sun, they get ready for their respective afternoons. Frey and Leland are biking out to Sconset for a late lunch in the garden at the Chanticleer. Cooper and Jake put on polo shirts and swim trunks and drive out to a beach called 40th Pole, stopping at Cisco Brewery on the way for beer so they don't show up empty-handed. It's been an A-plus day so far. Coop shot a 45 in golf, he was sharp and clear-headed, and he loved hanging out with his 2 best friends for 3 hours. He feels even more excited about this picnic and the chance to reconnect with Brooke. They had a flirty text conversation the evening before. Brooke was making a blueberry pie to bring to the picnic, and she would be wearing a blue bikini. They drive the Jeep up over the soft sand road that cuts between the dunes until they come down onto a flat curve of beach.
Jake, a woman calls out,
Coop!
The woman is blonde and wearing a blue bikini, so Coop figures it must be Brooke. She's with a group of people camped off to the right. She shows them where to park, and when Cooper climbs out of the Jeep, she throws her arms around his neck and gives him a big hug.
Okay, he thinks.
When they separate, he studies her face. She's pretty, smiling, and he does vaguely remember her from the other night. Vaguely. Apple is at the picnic with her husband Hugo and their twin boys, Caleb and Lucas, who are going to be seniors at the high school, and a bunch of other people whose names Coop tries to retain but loses after 10 seconds. He knows he doesn't have to worry about Jake. The guy raises money for a living and can talk to anyone about anything. Coop throws their case of beer into the tub of ice and cracks one open for him and one for Jake. This is the life, he thinks. Upside Down, by Jack Johnson, is playing on the portable speaker. The grills are smoking, and there's a table laden with food, including a blueberry pie with a lattice crust. Apple holds out a platter of oysters sitting in rapidly melting crushed ice.
Hugo just shucked these, she says. Please, have one.
Then you too come play some bocce, Hugo says. Jake, you're on my team.
No wonder my sister loved it here so much, Coop says to Apple.
You know something funny I remember about Mallory? Apple says. She never once came to our Labor Day picnic. She always claimed she was busy, every year.
Oh, she was busy, all right, Coop says. Bocce, Jake says.
Coop hopes that he will be as impressive at bocce as he was at golf that morning. But he's the weak link, probably because he's distracted by Brooke, who is waving her drink around, chanting his name, Cooper, Cooper. He wonders how much she's had to drink and then reminds himself not to judge. She's a teacher. This is her last full day of freedom. She's allowed to be enthusiastic. The 10th grade history teacher, whose name Cooper thinks is Nancy, comes around with a tray of pink cocktails in plastic cups.
Madigat Mysteries, she says, a Labor Day tradition.
Coop tastes one. It's strong and goes down way too easily. The Spanish teacher, Jill, comes by with buffalo chicken dip and Fritos, and Cooper is a sucker for Fritos. Then the ribs and jumbo shrimp come off the grill. This is the best day he's had in a long time, even though he loses badly at bocce.
Want to go for a walk, handsome?
Brooke asks. She has pulled on a diaphanous white cover-up, and she hands him another Madigat mystery.
Sure,
he says. He checks on Jake, who is deep in conversation with the biology teacher over by the deviled eggs. He catches Jake's eye, waves, and points to Brooke. They head down the beach, walking past kids building sandcastles and collecting shells, and a teenager on a skimboard who looks at Brooke and says,
What's up, Miss Schuster?
Without missing a beat, she says, See you Tuesday, Liam.
I love it, Cooper says. You see your students at the beach.
I see my students everywhere, Brooke says. It's a small island. She then tells Coop her basic story. She's 48 years old and has two kids, a son who's a sophomore at UMass and a daughter who will be a senior at the high school, in the same class as Caleb and Lucas. She lives on the island year-round in a rental that she fears the owners will someday sell out from under her. But she doesn't make enough on her teacher's salary to buy her own home.
I always wondered how Mallory did it, she says. She was a single mom too, right?
She was, Coop says. She inherited the cottage from our aunt when we were in our 20s. It's on the beach, but it's simple and pretty small. When my parents died, she had the money to finally renovate.
Well, sadly, I don't have a rich aunt to leave me a beachfront cottage, Brooke says.
She goes on to tell Coop that all of her family is in New Hampshire, which was where she lived before she got divorced from the children's father and decided she needed a change. She sighs.
So, what do you like to read?
Coop scrambles for one of the titles on Mallory's bookshelves, but he draws a blank. He was always the kid in English who skimmed the Cliff Notes 5 minutes before class.
I don't read for pleasure because I do so much policy analysis at work.
This answer is lame, and to distract Brooke, he reaches for her hand. It works. Maybe too well. Brooke pulls him into the water. He manages to shuck off his shirt, but she goes in with her cover-up still on, which strikes him as a bit odd. Brooke paddles out, then turns to splash him right in the face, and when he sputters, she says,
"Oh, I'm sorry, baby."
And while Coop is thinking, "Baby?" he hardly knows this woman. He wasn't even sure it was her when they pulled onto the beach, and he never would have recognized her on the street. She swims into his arms and starts kissing him.
"Whoa," he thinks, "that was fast."
"We should probably get back," he says. She splashes him again, right in the face.
"You're no fun."
As they're walking back, she says,
"So, how do I convince you to move into your sister's cottage and stay on Nantucket year-round?"
Coop laughs, even though he is now officially uncomfortable.
"Hopefully, in a few years when I retire, I'll be able to spend more time here."
"A few years," Brooke says. "I'll be off the market by then."
At a loss for how to respond, Coop quickens his pace. He's relieved when they get back to the party and Jake says,
"Leland called. We have to go."
"Did something happen?" Coop asks.
"She didn't say. She just told me we were needed at home."
Coop and Jake say their goodbyes, and Coop gives Brooke a hug and a quick kiss goodbye.
"I have your number," he says, "and you have mine if you ever get to Washington."
Brooke waves like crazy until the Jeep is up over the dunes.
"You like her?"
Jake says.
"Perfectly nice woman," Coop says, "and attractive. But we had exactly nothing in common, and I'm not unhappy to be leaving." "That's good to hear," Jake says. "You two were gone so long, I was afraid you'd proposed."
As they head down the no-name road, Coop wonders if he should be concerned. Frey and Leland both seemed giddy about their reunion, but all Coop can think now is that they had an argument. This would be par for the course with them, and Frey lost his temper and is threatening to leave. It would be sort of like what happened 30 years ago. But when they pull up to the cottage, Coop hears laughter and conversation coming from inside. He hears a woman who is not Leland. It sounds like... Coop throws open the screen door and steps inside. Frey and Leland are sitting at the narrow harvest table with Stacy.
Stacy?
She stands up and smiles at him. She's wearing a flowing white strapless dress and a pair of barely there sandals. She's every bit as captivating to Cooper as she was the first time he saw her in the basement of the Phi Gamma Delta house.
"Stace," he says, "what are you doing here?"
"I've had a change of heart," she says.
"So, if your offer still stands?" Coop sweeps her off the ground. He grins at his friends.
"I'm getting married," he says.
"For the last time," Stacy says.
Jake. On Monday, Frey generously offers to fly Jake back to South Bend on his private jet.
"It's on my way home," he says. "It's no problem to make a stop. I'll have my pilot add it to the flight plan."
Frey and Jake part ways with the others outside the terminal. Leland is heading to New York, Cooper and Stacy back to DC. Jake gives Coop and Stacy each a hug, as Frey and Leland share a very long kiss goodbye. "Wow," Stacy says, elbowing Coop.
Why don't you ever kiss me that way?
I do, Coop says, and he pulls Stacy closer.
Time for me to get out of here, Jake says.
He feels a lump rising in his throat as he recalls all the labor days that he kissed Mallory goodbye. No offense, but they put Frey and Leland to shame. Jake has never flown private before. It isn't something he's ever aspired to, and even when Ursula was an arm's length from the presidency, he never pictured himself aboard Air Force One.
Good thing.
Frey's plane is a Gulfstream 550, which Jake understands is a big deal. The plane has a pilot, a co-pilot, and a bubbly flight attendant named Heather. After Frey and Jake take seats in the living area, they're facing each other in buff leather chairs with a high-gloss table between them. Heather asks what they would like to drink. Jake is about to ask Heather for a Bloody Mary. Why not celebrate this crazy experience? When she says, "We have Classic Black, the Platinum, and," she pauses dramatically, "this jet is one of the few places in the world where you can get a bottomless cup of Frayed Edge Select Reserve."
Coffee. She's talking about coffee, of course. "We'll have two cups of the reserve. Thanks, Heather," Frey says. He looks at Jake. "Do you take anything in it?" "A cream, two sugars."
As soon as the words are out, he wonders if Frey will disapprove. Maybe drinking the reserve with cream and sugar is like dropping an ice cube into a glass of Chateau Lafite. Takeoff is smooth. Frey gazes out the window as Nantucket slips from view.
"Now that was a good weekend," Frey says. "I had no idea that was how things would turn out."
Heather appears with two mugs, the signature silver pot, and a pitcher of cream and tiny bowl of organic sugar cubes for Jake. She winks at Frey.
"I saw you on page 6, Mr. Dooley."
"That was me with Leland," he says. "I can't wait to introduce you to her."
"I've subscribed to Leland's letter for over 10 years, Heather says. "I didn't know the two of you were friends."
"It's a long story," Frey says. "Literally."
Jake sips his coffee. It's by far the best coffee he's ever tasted. Frey says,
"Heather, would you pack up a couple pounds of the reserve for Jake to take home?"
"Yes, sir, Mr. Dooley."
Once Heather leaves them, Jake says,
"So will you and Leland continue to see each other? Aren't you worried about the distance?" "I'm going to New York next weekend," Frey says. "I have a brownstone on East 3rd Street that I had renovated, and I've never spent the night there. That's about to change."
A brownstone in the East Village that he's never even slept in? It's only sinking in now just how wealthy Frey is. This is his jet. Those pilots are his pilots. Heather is his flight attendant. Whenever Jake has thought about Frazier Dooley in the past 30 years, his mind always conjured the angry young man who disappeared down the beach with a bottle of Jim Beam. Now, he's a billionaire who sells the world's finest coffee in the coolest cafes in the country. Jake has heard that the flagship Frayed Edge Cafe in Burlington, Vermont, has live music 24 hours a day. Billie Eilish has played there, Luke Combs, Ingrid Michaelson.
"I could use your help with something," Jake says.
"Anything,"
Frey says.
"I'm going to need a date for Coop's wedding."
"Sorry, man, I already have a date," Frey says, and they both laugh.
Jake pulls out his phone.
"Have you ever used a dating app?"
He figures this is a stupid question. Frey is a billionaire, so, before Leland, there must have been a line of eligible women after him.
"No, man, but I'm friends with the woman who created Firepink, and that's the app you want. It's for users over 40, and it's marketed toward professionals."
"Firepink?" Jake says. "What about Bumble or Match.com? Is Match still a thing?"
He laughs.
Honestly, I'm used to meeting women the old-fashioned way. I met Ursula in 6th grade.
I hear you, Frey says. I met Leland when we were kids, and I met Anna at the cafe. Her band played there one night, and I fell in love.
He's quiet, and Jake wonders why it's no longer popular to meet someone in real life.
But trust me, you want Firepink. Here, I'll download it for you.
Frey takes Jake's phone and taps and swipes. Then he hands the phone back to Jake and says,
fill out the answers to these questions and click the Fire Up button. This app goes through tens of thousands of profiles in lightning speed and picks the top 3 women. I've heard you should always choose number 1. They have the highest success rate in the business with the first match. Their algorithm is magic.
Jake chuckles.
All I need is a wedding date.
Still, he fills out the answers for his profile and then, once he's double-checked his responses, he presses the Fire Up button. The phone flips through faces like a Vegas dealer through a deck of cards. Jake thinks he sees a bunch of attractive women, but it's moving too fast and he can't make it stop. Until finally, a face appears on the screen. Jake blinks. It's a striking, dark-haired woman in what he recognizes as an Alexander McQueen suit. Ursula de Guernsey, age 56, nickname Sully, height 5'6", hair dark brown, eyes brown, occupation attorney M&A, address New York City, political party independent, birthplace South Bend, Indiana, favorite pastime work. Jake laughs.
We're supposed to go with the first choice, huh?
Yeah, Frey says. Did you already match with someone? Let me see.
Not yet, Jake says. I'm going to ask her out and I don't want you to jinx it.
Yeah, bro, go for it, Frey says. You're a boss.
Jake doesn't reach out to his ex-wife via Firepink. He texts her instead.
Heading back to the Bend, he says. Guess what? Coop is getting married again. His 6th wedding. Next June in D.C.
Jake sees the 3 floating dots, indicating that his number 1 match, maybe Firepink does know best after all, is writing back. Need a date? She asks. This has been a Hachette Audio production of The 6th Wedding, written by Ellen Hildebrand, read by Aaron Bennett, produced by Lisa Kahn, directed by Dennis Kao, post-production by Fred Koch and Jeremy Wesley, recorded at Literati Audio Studios. The 6th Wedding is also available in e-book format from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2021 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2021 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.